In the glitz and glamour of the Roaring Twenties, a shadow looms. Jim Crow, the KKK, Prohibition, the Mafia. And in the swirling backdrop of death and hate and revenge, our lovers meet, determined to prove that they can stand above it all. I'm Heather Songster, and this is Hopelessly Romantic. Welcome back, readers and romance seekers, to another episode. We'll swing our way back into the historical genre with A Blues Singer to Redeem Him by L. Jackson. Before we get started, today's show will touch on themes concerning racial and sexual violence. Now, you might know that while we've done historical before, this will be the first under Harlequin's umbrella, and it's one that I've had my eye on since it popped up in the new releases page. This book really stood out to me for several reasons. See, whenever I looked into the historical offerings from Harlequin, they were at least a couple of centuries removed from our own. By looking at the title, we can tell that this takes place not so very long ago. I also kind of really don't like it. I know it's not unusual or strange for awkward titles to live in the Harlequin lineup, so more or less I want to let it go. However, I think this one is particularly egregious. I'll talk more about that at the end, though. Now, while taking place in the 1920s is unusual enough, what really got my attention was the couple featured in the story, a white man and a black woman. This, to me, seemed rather unusual, since I rarely ever saw mixed couples in these romance books. I think it's sorely lacking in today's social climate, and so I'm excited to have found this story. I'm not going to say that I'm an expert on the interracial romance genre, but let's say that I have a vested interest in seeing more of these types of stories in popular media. And let's take a quick look at our author, yeah? L. Jackson is a woman of color from the Midwest. I normally wouldn't make a note on the author's race, but here I feel that it's important, since from what I've gathered from her about the author blurb on both her website and the book itself, she seems to have drawn her own experiences as a black woman growing up in a very white partition of the United States for this book. And she has quite the resume as well. The book blurb states that she has a doctorate in educational leadership, a master of fine arts in writing popular fiction, and a master of arts in teaching. And she's a wife and mother of two to boot. I'm not sure what I was in for by reading this book, but with that background, I knew that I was in for something interesting. To get the party started, we will begin with the cover as always. The couple are the entire focus of the shot. A black woman dressed in a flapper gown with pinned hair and a rope of pearls at her neck, being held and embraced by a white man in a suit. I'm not an expert on suits from the 20s, so I really couldn't tell if it's representative or not. The background is barely visible, to the point where I can't really see what it is, only that there's impressions of gold and chandelier lights. Our story begins on May 31st, 1921, in Greenwood, Oklahoma, with a sentence that I will never forget. Evelyn LaRoque had never smelled human flesh burn. If you're like me, the date didn't really stand out at first, but with that opening line, it brought it home for me. Our story is starting with the Tulsa Massacre, where Black Wall Street was burned and bombed in the worst outbreaks of racial violence in the United States, leaving thousands homeless, devastating a hub of Black culture and livelihood, and killing, well, the numbers are argued even to this day. And it's in this backdrop we meet a young Evelyn, confused at the chaos outside the home she shared with her parents, and why the cops weren't stepping up to protect them from the violence, and why her mother, usually a fighter, was insisting on running. Against her protests, Evelyn's mother gets her into the car, and they speed away from the burning city. But hope leaves them as they become trapped by the white mob. The story starts proper 5 years later with Lorenzo Di Luca. He's arrived at his old family mansion, and context clues tell us he's basically the son of a mafia don. A flashback will tell us that his father wants him to take over the family business, and Lorenzo wants nothing to do with it. But he's visiting the family home today to see his mother, and he gets news that his cousin Vinny had been killed by the KKK, along with Vinny's fiance, a woman of color. It becomes very clear that Lorenzo's father, Alonzo, has less than savory thoughts on the black community, and Lorenzo is pretty furious about the entire situation. Alonzo is basically whinging about how awful it is that Lorenzo wants to turn his back on the family, and Lorenzo just wants to walk away from the cycle of violence and make his own way in the world. He leaves the mansion feeling empty and lost. I'll pause to mention here that the perspective shifts a lot. Nearly every chapter begins with switching from whichever perspective we had in the last chapter, and they're not long either, only a couple of pages, so it was a bit disorienting and a little hard for me to summarize the book without constantly saying, back to this character, so bear with me as I muddle through that. We return to Evelyn in her grandmother's home, where through exposition we learn that her parents did die in the Tulsa Massacre, and that she's discovered her grandmother hasn't been able to keep up on bills, so her home is in risk of foreclosure. Evelyn is hoping to achieve her dreams of becoming a blues singer by getting a lead singer job in a club. She saved enough money to tide things over financially, and hopefully will have enough time to establish a singing career in Kansas City. It's been a month since Lorenzo learned of the death of his cousin, and he finds himself staring down one of the KKK perps in his club, the Blues Moon. The white supremacist group had been trying to recruit him, or at least his club resources, and Lorenzo's been tugging them along, only to get information on Vinny's murder. I do find it rather interesting that the KKK is soliciting Lorenzo at all, since they weren't fond of Italians, much as they weren't fond of people of color. It looks as though the DeLuca's influence on Kansas City enticed the KKK into if you can't beat 'em, join 'em strategy. And there's a couple of demands that they have if Lorenzo is going to join them, namely that he wouldn't cater to black customers any longer. Lorenzo obviously refutes him and feels a side of himself that he'd rather forget as he throws the guy out of the club. Don't come back in here. Or the next time you might not walk out. Don't forget who I am. I can make you disappear, and no one would dare ask me about it. Lorenzo tightened his grip around the man's throat, seriously considering choking him until he passed out. It had been a while since Lorenzo's temper had gotten the best of him, but Simmons had brought out a side of him that he tried to hide even from himself. This side, the anger and violence, took Lorenzo back to a time when he thought he would follow in his father's footsteps. That was before what had happened to Holly, his high school sweetheart, the only girl he'd ever cared for. So, as much as he'd like to separate himself from his family, Lorenzo is still fighting the very foundations that raised him, especially in the face of an ugly and violent monster. And don't think I missed the visit from the dead woman trope in there either. Holly gets mentioned a few times throughout the story to remind Lorenzo of his family's problems, serving to push him further to distance himself from them. Lorenzo releases Simmons, and as the scumbag walks out, in comes Evelyn. And because racists got a racist, he decides that it's an excellent idea to grab her and threaten her in front of Lorenzo. Of course, Lorenzo won't stand for that at all, and he sucker punches the creep right into the floor. Through it all, Evelyn is cool as a cucumber. She's seen the worst that humanity has on offer, and one stupid racist isn't going to faze her. Lorenzo ends up being the one flabbergasted with her chilled demeanor, and is quickly falling head over heels for her. In the text, Lorenzo's attraction to Evelyn begins purely physical, and almost borderline obsessive, as though every thought or goal he's ever had got swept right off the table and replaced with a giant golden idol of Evelyn. Evelyn has to only mention that she's looking for a job as a lead singer to get Lorenzo to drop pretty much everything in that moment to cater to her. I'd love to hear your voice. You want to sing something now? Lorenzo had, in fact, already hired a lead singer, but for some reason he didn't care about that. He'd auditioned probably a dozen beautiful women. Most of them had pretty good voices, but Lorenzo wanted. No, he needed to hear this woman sing. He'd got that feeling in his gut that something spectacular was about to happen. Evelyn is, of course, sensational. Lorenzo takes her back to his office and pretty much hires her on the spot. For some reason, he decides to tell her that the role had already been filled, but he wanted her more. I'm not sure why, if only to show us that Lorenzo wasn't completely thoughtless by assuring Evelyn that the other girl would have another job by the end of the day. And against all odds, we get a B-plot about a charity event, one to raise money for an impoverished family, where Evelyn is more than happy to help. I was really hoping not to see this particular plot device again, but unlike the last episode with the surgeon and the princess, it thankfully does not dominate the story. What does dominate is an abundance of secondary characters. There are so many people in this book besides the main couple that I sometimes forgot that I was reading an erotic romance novel. In theory, mostly because of word count restraints and the nature of the stories, I'd wager that the limited cast size was simply for readability. If we look back to episodes 3 and 4 with Cold Case Colorado that shoved new people down our throats constantly, we know that overloading us with new people is exhausting. While I read the dreaded Triple C, I kept thinking to myself, oh god, another one to keep track of? Here, it wasn't as egregious, at least to my taste, but other readers might find it frustrating. There's the band that Evelyn will sing with at the Blues Moon, led by Benny, along with other of Lorenzo's employees, a young boy caught filching from the kitchens, various family members on both sides of our couple, and of course, the white-hooded villains. We meet one of these cast members, Tommy, who works at the bar, as he discusses with Lorenzo about the situation with the KKK and whether or not they were finally able to pin Mitt Vinny's murder on the crew. The best suspect that they have is Simmons, who is already on Lorenzo's list. The way the two talk makes it sound like a lot of the people who work at the club are recovering mafiosos, and Lorenzo is desperate to refrain from resorting to mafia tactics and violence. He resolves to put Simmons away legally. Evelyn returns that night to the club for her first time on stage. She stops to see Lorenzo first, and we get the return of Spark of Something, but unusually, almost entirely on Lorenzo's side. Like I mentioned before, he is completely crazy about Evelyn and doing his damnedest to keep professional. He seems to manage it well enough as he gives her a short tour through the club to get her bearings. Evelyn, on the other hand, is fighting herself, mostly out of self-preservation. She hasn't been fully hit with the SOS the way Lorenzo has, but she is compelled by him, except she knows that she can't really fully trust him. See, Lorenzo lives in a world where he can occasionally pass as white. Remember, this is back in a time when Italians were demonized as non-white. But to Evelyn, a white man is a white man, the same sort who killed her parents in a violent mob, and it's more than difficult to let her guard down. Even as she walks into the stage for her first set, she's racked with memories of that night, using them to put emotion and power into her voice. After the set, Lorenzo congratulates her and shows her to her new dressing room, which has been filled with flowers and food. He encourages her to rest, but she's still buzzing from singing that she asks him to stay and talk. He gets to know a little about her, how she's always wanted to sing, and how she's always taken care of her grandmother. He is a perfect gentleman, and she can feel herself thawing towards him, which, of course, makes her put up more walls. She asks to be left alone, saying that she's going to take his advice to relax and get some alone time. A little while later, she hears a commotion out in the club and rushes out to see what was happening. It looks like the KKK bullies are trying to cause a ruckus as payback for what happened to Simmons. It's interesting how they're described compared to the other people in the club. Messy hair, mud-covered overalls, and big boots. It's a very stereotypical description of, well, white trash hicks. It's a heavy-handed metaphor, but it gets the message across. Here we get a pretty good look at Dredd, who, if I remember correctly, is Lorenzo's half-sister via his father's mistress. But she is no wallflower. She is apparently some kind of Black Widow type, and she efficiently handles the KKK by sticking them full of drugs before any of them saw that she was coming. Their bodies get drug out somewhere that they can sleep it off, and Lorenzo is surprised to see that Evelyn had come down to the club ready to fight. Now that it's calm again, and in a perfect example of the never-ending party that was the 20s, she goes to sing her next set to the delight of the patrons. She finishes up, and it's time for her to go home, but Lorenzo stepped out, and she wanted to tell him thank you. She decides that, well, it's rather late, and she might as well just go ahead and go home, but Lorenzo did return just in time, and they get to say goodbye. When she opened the door, the gold light from outside formed an aura around her like she was a goddess. Her round, full bottom and toned calves nearly had Lorenzo on his knees. He wanted to show her what it meant to be cherished. Her voice, her presence, awoke something inside of him that he didn't really understand. He wanted to know more about her. The pain in her eyes pierced him each time she looked at him. What had happened to her? This is why I say that Lorenzo was becoming borderline obsessed with her. He's become completely infatuated despite spending only a few hours in her company, and we are at real risk of this getting out of control. But he does also remark on her bravery, noting that she had stared down those racist thugs like it was nothing, intensifying his curiosity. We catch up with Evelyn on the train as she's traveling home to a place called West Eden. From what I gathered, West Eden is a Black community, much like Tulsa's Black Wall Street had been, but its location was kept secret from most outsiders. I tried to do some research to see if it was based on anything real, but I haven't found anything yet. My best guess so far is that West Eden is meant as a sort of what-if, maybe wish fulfillment, a sign of hope after a massive, tragic loss. She exits the train and all seems well until she's struck in the head and falls down onto the ground. Fighting pain, she sees that Simmons has caught up to her, this time with a friend. Jeb, Lorenzo's second in charge at the club, had made sure that Evelyn had got onto the train safely. However, he also saw Simmons get on the same train and took no time in telling Lorenzo, who was now speeding as fast as his car could take them, to Evelyn. They find her getting slapped around by Simmons, who distressingly has his pants around his ankles. I'm going to say that I agonized adding that detail, but I think it needs to be said. We know that a large and popular trope in romantic and erotic literature is the damsel in distress scenario. Even I've admitted to being a fan. But there's something much, much darker here. I've said before that fiction is an excellent way to engage with the themes and scenarios in a safe environment. All you have to do to leave the situation is just to close the book. That's why I think The Damsel in Distress is so popular. It's almost like a trust fall. We, as women, can engage with a threat that exists as this background radiation that permeates our entire lives. We know that the heroine will be okay. She will be rescued, and we can experience the catharsis of the assault or capture being thwarted. But as I read the description of Evelyn being beaten bloody because she dared to fight back when Simmons tried to rape her, and Lorenzo dragging him off of her and beating his face in, I felt no catharsis, only rage. Unlike some of the dreamlike fantasies that we've read before now, like imaginary palaces, heroic swashbucklers, protective alphas, places where a woman is rescued and we can fall further into the fantasy, this is real. This is a real thing that happened over and over and over again. And how many times did a rescue come at the very last moment? I'm certain we know the answer to that. There may be a catharsis here, but I don't think it's for me. It's for the scores of women of color who have been beaten, brutalized, assaulted, and murdered, and ignored. The author stated at the beginning of the book that She loved to write stories that showcase the beauty of diversity, and she's certainly doing that with this novel. But with this scene, I believe that she had something to say about racial violence, especially as it concerns violence committed towards women of color. It may seem odd to us in here in the year of our Lord 2021 that there was once a time in America when people with white skin were not counted among the purely white ideals of groups like the KKK, the Jewish people, the Irish, and the Italians. But if they were careful, they could theoretically pass as a fully white individual if they so chose. Black Americans and people of color have no such opportunities. So in this scene, we see Lorenzo, who has been seeing prosecution as an Italian, but could wear both his skin and his family as a cloak of protection and privilege, coming to the rescue of a woman who has no such recourse. It says a lot about community, I think, about persecuted communities coming together for the protection of the group as a whole. It's a hell of a metaphor, but it's entirely my own interpretation. Your mileage may vary. So where were we before I veered off into that rant? Ah yes, Lorenzo was bashing Simmons' face in. Evelyn, showing a grace worthy of the godhood Lorenzo projected onto her, stops him from outright killing the man, and Lorenzo gets a grip back on his senses. Ensuring that bones hadn't been broken or any other truly major injuries, Evelyn asks to be returned to the club, not wanting to go back home in her current state. Lorenzo does as she asks and brings her up to his apartment in the penthouse of the club building. He helps her clean up and checks the scrapes, and then goes full Italian by cooking her a meal. As they eat, they talk. They talk about their families, how they navigate their obligations. Lorenzo fully admits to being caught in the middle of trying to separate himself from his family and the family business. Evelyn talks about the past keeping up with him, vaguely referencing her own trials. It's gentle and tender, exactly what we need after the horror that Evelyn had just gone through. Lorenzo insists that she needs some rest and offers one of the apartments below his, since he owns the entire building. In fact, he offers it to her to use permanently, and that gets her hackles up. See, she's seen Dredd and Lorenzo together, not knowing their relationship, and she's concerned that he's trying to buy her off to become his mistress. How quickly she jumps to that conclusion makes me wonder how often she's been propositioned like this. No matter, though, she has too much pride to even think about becoming the other woman, and leaves, promising to be on time that night for her next shift. She calls her brother to pick her up, and right about the time when he pulls up, Jeb runs up to her, insisting to return to the club so that they could go over her contract, which he suggested should include the room and board. So all three of them, Jeb, Evelyn, and her brother Carmichael, all go into the club to have some food and discuss the contract. Assured that Evelyn was all right, her brother leaves, and she's given the key to her new apartment. Later on, when Lorenzo meets up with her to clear the air, Evelyn recognizes that she's certainly falling for him, but it's complicated. Lorenzo stared at her with that same intensity that Evelyn was beginning to enjoy very much. The tips of her fingers tingled as he reached over and squeezed her hand, grazing the top of her thigh where her hands were tightly clasped. He was paying her a very generous salary, plus allowing her to stay in the apartment for free. How would she ever be able to repay him? She sighed loudly. She couldn't be indebted to him. He would have power over her. And the fact that he was a white man, well, she just didn't want to owe him anything. I appreciate that the author is aware of the power dynamics between these two individuals, something I wish I could see more of, instead of, you know, women getting thrown into situations calculated by the men who claim to love them. Lorenzo is infatuated, no doubt about it, but he knows when to back off as far as romance is concerned. So instead of pursuing Evelyn romantically, Lorenzo focuses on his projects, the charity fundraiser, and also ridding Kansas City of the KKK, so Evelyn and other women like her would be safe. It's good to know that he wasn't turned on to the latter of these concerns after Evelyn's arrival. It's an effective way to show us that Lorenzo has been an ally for a while. Unfortunately, he gets a call from his father. Alonso tells him that they've received word that the KKK is planning to target Evelyn in order to get to Lorenzo. And I'm expecting Lorenzo to keep this to himself. I've seen it so many times before. The guy gets into his head that he has to protect his lady friend, but not tell her that he needs to protect her, and then she blows up at him for not telling her she was in danger. But he doesn't. Lorenzo tells Evelyn that they're keeping an eye on the situation, and that he'll do everything in his power to protect her. He's incredibly honest about it. Even that night, before her set, he stops by her dressing room to make sure she understands that not only is she targeted by the KKK, but that also working for him in the Blues Moon, she'll be associated with the mob, even if Lorenzo does what he can to separate himself from his family business. Here we get some of their first genuinely intimate moments, and I continue to root for Lorenzo when he asks to kiss her. He doesn't guess or make a move or force her into it. He asks for the kiss, and she agrees. They get completely swept up in the passion of the embrace just before they remember that Evelyn's dressing room is wide open and they should probably have more decorum than that. After a few awkward moments and goodbyes, Evelyn goes to sing for the club and Lorenzo goes to meet with his father to get information on Vinny's murder. Sounds like Mr. Simmons has been rather busy, since he was responsible for Vinny's death in an attempt to get to Vinny's fiancée. The KKK had no idea that they've brought the wrath of the mob down on their heads, but it's clear that Simmons, at the very least, needs to be handled. Lorenzo returns to the club, eager to hear Evelyn sing her last set. After she's done, he invites her for a dance, and they enjoy each other's company until it's time for breakfast. Evelyn is clearly exhausted, and he takes her up to his penthouse to cook her food, and she rather sleepily makes a move on him. And if we didn't love Lorenzo before, he knows that she's tired and a little tipsy from a drink that Tommy had given her, so gently declines and lets her sleep. When she wakes up and gets her bearings, they talk a little bit more about the threat from the KKK and about working through pain. Finally, they kiss again, and now that they aren't exposed in a dressing room, they can have a bit more fun with it. Lorenzo continues to be a gentleman, though, when Evelyn asks for him to go slow, and he doesn't do anything she doesn't want. They only kiss, and when they separate, Evelyn needs to go back to her home in West Eden to pick up a few things and to reassure her grandmother that she's all right. Lorenzo offers her a ride. Originally, she would have been driven by a club employee, Jerry, and they make their way out of Kansas City. When they arrive, Lorenzo gets to meet Evelyn's grandmother, who isn't thrilled about a white man in what was supposed to be a secret refuge for people of color. Evelyn goes upstairs to collect some things, and her grandmother does what we all expect, and grill Lorenzo about his intentions. So far, she seems to be placated, not entirely convinced, probably because she only sees Lorenzo as an employer, not a partner. They have another night of a heart-to-heart back at the club after Evelyn finishes singing, and we get another false start to that physical relationship, with Lorenzo fully understanding his position. He's her employer, he's older, the power balance is not equal, and he doesn't want to hurt her by pushing her into a relationship with him, as much as he would like to do. I love how focused he is on keeping Evelyn comfortable, but Evelyn isn't really saying no either. As time goes on, she's able to see how genuine Lorenzo is with his support and affection, and she's comfortable in his company. And I think it's worth something, despite what Lorenzo might think. But for now, the couple hasn't gotten together yet. Instead, Lorenzo will continue to try to focus on his work, and he gets word from Dredd and Tommy that they know that the KKK is going to make a big move, but they need to go deep undercover in order to sniff out what's going to happen. Things are moving faster, even to the point where a dirty cop decides to drop a hint to Lorenzo that there's a price on Evelyn's head, even though he's not on good terms with the DeLucas from what it looks like. After another night of singing, the Blues Moon team have a meeting to discuss their white supremacist infestation, and Lorenzo is determined to do things without violence, without mob connections, using city officials he was friendly with and the press. After the meeting, he gets a call from his mother, encouraging him to introduce Evelyn to the family and using their connections to get her jobs, and more importantly, protection. Lorenzo promises her he'll think about it, and as he hangs up, Evelyn walks into the room. She's decided that she wants to tell him about Greenwood and the massacre in Tulsa, admitting that the worst part was that the world seemed to forget about it, like it never happened. And she's also decided that life is too short, too special, to pass up any opportunity that presents itself. Evelyn got to her feet and held her hand out to Lorenzo. He took her hand and stood up. She led him down the hall to his bedroom. His mind raced. He wanted her. He wanted her so badly. But he couldn't shake the fact that being with him would put her in even more peril. Evelyn, I don't know if this is a good idea. Evelyn shut the door when they were both inside the room. The dim light from the lamp next to his massive bed glowed gold, casting shadows on the wall. Evelyn walked toward him. Looking at her beautiful eyes, lush lips, and glowing skin made him hard. Oh, God. He didn't think he could be strong enough to fight his desire for her. But Lorenzo finally relents, and they make love. The sex is different in this book. It pushes a lot of the boundaries I feel we haven't touched on yet in these books. There is an awkward moment, at least awkward to me, where Evelyn is worried about Lorenzo's size, but otherwise it flows naturally. But it is also more graphic than I think we've seen, and based on what I've seen so far from Harlequin, I'm glad for the change. Now that they've experienced physical intimacy, they can start opening up to more emotional intimacy. They talk about themselves, about each other a few hours later, but before it's time to go back to the club. A week later, Lorenzo takes Evelyn to his winery outside of town. I mean, it may be prohibition, but that won't stop an enterprising club owners from making and selling wine and moonshine. Before they get to their evening, Dredd had stopped by to tell Lorenzo that their planned ambush on the KKK was almost ready, and also that the Ricci family, rivals to the DeLucas, were riling up as well. There's some old bad blood between the families, some of it related to Lorenzo's murdered girlfriend, Holly. Lorenzo mentions that it's a cycle of violence. One family kills a member of another family, and then they retaliate, and it goes on and on. I think that this touches on the overall theme of the book, as it relates to the violence that they've all experienced. In their own ways, they are trying to escape from the trauma of cyclical violence, heal from it, and end it on their own terms. Violence begets violence, and in some way, they're all trying to stop it. The night of Lorenzo's fundraiser arrives, and he's trying to get it to pull double duty. First, he's raising money for his charity, and second, he's going to try to send a message to the KKK, but they've already sent their own. As Lorenzo and Evelyn make their appearance to the swarm of reporters for the event, a large burning cross is raised nearby, and Lorenzo moves Evelyn safely inside. He offers her the opportunity to leave, but she insists on staying. If she leaves, they win, she tells him. And after all, half the folks here at the fundraiser were here to hear her sing. She entertains the crowd for a while, and Lorenzo can tell when she's getting to her limit, at least emotionally. Even the bravest of folks would be shaken after a direct threat from a white supremacist group. He takes her back to her apartment, and they share another night of intimacy together. The next morning, their moment of bliss is shattered. Lorenzo's mother came for a visit, urging him to take Evelyn and flee from the city, since both the KKK and the Ricci family were really ramping up their threats. He also gets a call from Dredd, reinforcing that the KKK is going to make a serious move. It's all too much for Lorenzo, so he does the one thing that he thinks would be the best for Evelyn. He tells her that she should leave, without saying much else why. There were other clubs that would be glad to have her, far, far away from Kansas City. I'm set on calling this trope the third act separation. In so many of these, we get a breakup at nearly the ending point of the novel, and I'm personally not a huge fan. At least, I'm not a fan when a misunderstanding is the reason, or a person gets some nonsense stuck into their head and it pulls the couple apart. Looking back at episode 2 with She Dreamed of a Cowboy, that might be the only separation that I can really go along with. The couple didn't want to split up, but it wasn't up to them. An external conflict had pulled them apart, and it was up to them to settle things to make it right and return to each other. It's really hard for me to go along with Lorenzo here. He gave Evelyn an apartment directly above the club she's working in, and said club is stuffed to the brim with staff who have all come to adore her in their own way. The only way I can justify Lorenzo's train of thought is that he thinks the KKK or the Ricci family is just gonna burn the place down. But that doesn't mean he has to break up with her. Just tell her to lay low for a while, go to West Eden, spend time with her grandmother, and come back when it's safer. I guess the story needs some angst, though, so here we are, with Lorenzo sacrificing his love for Evelyn to keep her safe. Evelyn is furious and deeply wounded by the sudden dismissal. We already know she's not afraid of a challenge, and she's already stated that if she runs, they win. It's not in her nature to back down from the things that threaten her or her loved ones. But it doesn't matter. He sends her away and refocuses on the upcoming ambush on the KKK. Evelyn, of course, does not do what he expected, and really, I'm shocked that he thought it would work. She instead goes to another club in a different part of the city, and it is purely to showcase how amazing working at the Blues Moon had been for her. She easily could have found work anywhere else, especially with Lorenzo's offer to provide references. But instead she's wandered into this place called Avalon, a segregated club with a more seedy appearance. The staff is rude to her, and the owner is worse. And to really drive home how awful this place is, the owner instructs her to use the back entrance when she arrives to sing that night. I am absolutely floored that Evelyn puts up with this. It's almost as if she's trying to spite Lorenzo by choosing the absolute worst place to work. She starts packing up her apartment, telling herself that once she has the money from working at Avalon, she can get her own place. Lorenzo stops by, again telling her that she needs to get out of the city, and offering an opportunity at a club in Colorado, run by somebody he knows. For now, she sees him out, and he goes off to talk to Dredd and Tommy about the upcoming ambush. Turns out that the KKK boys just love that club, Avalon. Evelyn is completely unaware, of course. Gosh, it would have been avoided, I'm sure, if Lorenzo had kept her in the loop. She leaves for her first shift, and Lorenzo's driver, Jerry, insists on driving her over in a Rolls Royce. She's initially hesitant, but finally agrees. Defiantly, she enters through the front and begins her set, quickly gaining a rapport with the only person of color in the club, a pianist called Easy with a Z. She sings for a while and decides to take a break. The club owner is apparently an absolute idiot and insists that she keep singing, even though it's crucial for her to rest her voice occasionally. She's insistent, and since there's nowhere else to rest, she has to go out the back and into the cold. Easy joins her for a moment, but she assures him that she will be fine on her own, so he goes back inside. Alone with her thoughts, she decides that it's not worth it, and will only sing this one night at the Avalon. If it were me, I would just leave right then and there, but it wouldn't matter anyway. From the shadows comes Simmons. Evelyn warns him not to come closer, but he doesn't care. He keeps pushing forward, making the most vile threats. As soon as he's close enough, Evelyn takes her hidden knife and stabs him in the stomach. Dredd had also arrived at that exact moment and pushes Simmons to the ground, causing the knife to go further into his body. She takes Evelyn, telling her that they need to get out before it's too late, but before they can make a run for it, they are surrounded by Klansmen. Lorenzo had arrived along with possibly every cop he could trust in the city and backup of his own. He gives the clan one last verbal warning that they should walk away or else be completely exposed by the press and fired from their jobs. The clan hurls insults right back, and that sparks the ire of a new arrival, a boss from the Ritchie family, and from there a fight breaks out. Lorenzo manages to make his way to Evelyn, and he does what he can to pull her to the roadster so he can get her out of the fray. But when he sees the barrel of a gun pointed at her, he doesn't hesitate. He shields her with his body and takes the bullet. They fall to the ground together, and he passes out. For 1 second, I think the book actually killed him, in a West Side Story-style ending. But, thankfully, we have to remember what genre we're reading, and I am wrong. Lorenzo is taken to a hospital, and they won't know if he'll survive until he wakes up. The moment he wakes up and lays eyes on Evelyn, he knows what he wants. He'll go straight, quitting, making moonshine, leave his family in the city, and build a new club in West Eden with Evelyn as his wife. The expected epilogue shows us just that. They were busy with getting the new club, Gold Sun, ready for the grand opening. Everyone had joined them in West Eden, from Dredd and Jeb to Benny's band from Blues Moon and even Easy from Avalon. There's lots of work to be done, both in the club and in the nation. It'll be hard, but if they're together, they know that they can accomplish anything. And that is a blues singer to redeem him. And, well, there is a lot for me to process. Obviously, the book touches on some very serious social ills that still haunt us in the present day. The KKK, while not nearly as powerful as they were in the 20s, still operate today under the anonymity of white hoods. Black women and women of color are some of our most vulnerable members of society, and there's still so much that needs to be done to eliminate the risks to their community. After the snooze fest that was the surgeon and the princess from the last episode, I wanted a challenge and I got it. There were more than a few moments when I was genuinely uncomfortable with the events and the language used, but that's not a bad thing. How does that saying go? Art should comfort the disturbed and disturb the comfortable. I am thrilled to see this kind of story in the Harlequin lineup, and I desperately want more of it. Pulpy romance novels can tackle serious themes alongside erotic prose and fluffy affection, so long as it's balanced correctly. And I do believe L. Jackson found that balance in A Blues Singer to Redeem Him. Oh, yeah, about that title. Like I said, I hate it. Completely. It was this book that convinced me that the authors might not have full control over what they call their novels, because this title is terrible. Lorenzo didn't need redemption. He needed absolution. He needed to forgive himself for the grief of being associated with his family and all that it entailed. His entire story arc was him attempting to achieve redemption, when what he needed was acceptance of his past and gaining the strength to move forward. And that title moves Evelyn into a supporting role. It implies that it's Lorenzo's story and she's only there to fix him. Really, the story belongs to the both of them, and they're able to find peace and absolution together. So with that, we can get into Heather's final score. The cover is going to get a 5 out of 5. It does an excellent job of establishing our time frame, setting the tone, and showcasing the intimacy of our couple. It is a simple composition, but sometimes simplicity is all we need. Drama will get a 5 out of 5 as well. The setting of the Roaring Twenties lends itself particularly well to the chaos that can surround a new relationship that we find in the Harlequin stacks. Pressure is felt from all sides, the mob, the KKK, and even the racial tension that permeated that era. It gave us a lot to worry over, but in my opinion, it wasn't over the top. Romance is 4.5 out of 5. It's almost there. They had excellent chemistry, but the beginning pushed me off a bit with Lorenzo's obsessive descriptions, and then with the end and the third act breakup for what I consider stupid reasons. If the breakup hadn't been based on Lorenzo's wild assumptions that she would be safer without him, it would have made it. Realism gets a 5 out of 5. The 20s aren't quite living memory anymore, but they're close. They're close enough that I felt as though I didn't have to reach too far to settle myself into the story. While the book isn't based on any actual story that I know of, I'm certain that the events within it have happened in some way, shape, or form. The mob took the opportunity that Prohibition opened. The KKK did everything in their power to terrorize black and other non-white communities, and segregation left scars that are still visible today in some areas. This was real, and it felt real. I'm really pleased with this week's selection, even if I did hate that title. I firmly believe that Elle Jackson had something that she wanted to say with this book, and I think she said it. For my final rating, A Blues Singer to Redeem Him gets a place on the Gold Star shelf with 5 upscale speakeasies out of 5. Thank you for joining me, readers and romance seekers, and I hope to see you once again for Hopelessly Romantic. If you like the show, please visit us at hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. If you have questions or just want to say hi, please email us at contact@hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. The show is written and produced by me, Heather Songster. Our technical advisor is Kwang Hin Cho, and Hopelessly Romantic is an H with K production. And of course, it doesn't matter what you read, only that it's what you love.